If you're purchasing a new home or refinancing your existing home, then you need to call Team Hochberg, your trusted local lender, 855-563-2843, or visit 56diva.com. Lower.com, equal housing lender, MLS 112-4061.
Anna DeVlantis joins us for This Week in Chicago History now. And Anna, it's, let's see, 40 years since this big Arlington racetrack fire, isn't it?
You know, your listeners will no doubt remember this. If you were around 40 years ago, that massive fire, Bob, that broke out at Arlington Racetrack, just reducing it to ashes. There was this valiant effort to save it. I still remember watching it on the news that firefighters had moved in from all around. There was 150 of them making these heroic attempts to try to save it. But they were called away just a few hours later as it was deemed too unsafe to try to fight that fire. The clubhouse roof was built in such a way that it was likely it was going to collapse on them. There were multiple areas above them, and it just wasn't safe. So the great news about the whole thing was that no people were injured, no horses were injured either. Interestingly, the firefighters and the trainers moved in quickly to salvage the papers, these documents, 2,000 of them, that belong to the horses, that are like titles to a car, essentially. You can't race a horse on any track without them, and they did get those out. So that was good. But the interesting thing, too, here, Bob, is you talk about odds makers. What were the chances that you would race again that season at Arlington? Most people would say not a chance, no way, but somehow 3 weeks later, they somehow were able to run the Arlington Million at Arlington Racetrack. They just figured out a way to cart away tons of the ashes and debris, and they cleared the track, and they set up these temporary grandstands and structures, and somehow they ran the race. We pulled a tidbit from the Channel 2 News the night of the fire. It will remind you of the sheer devastation that they experienced there at the racetrack.
Great to hear John again.
And John Bulldog Drummond.
And Harry Porterfield there. The track did reopen, didn't it?
It did. They rebuilt it, Bob, into its splendor and a few years later. And it was in existence for 100 years before closing in 2021. So
now back to this week in 1995 and a great honor for one of our favorite people.
Jim Lovell got the Congressional Space Medal of Honor this week, 1995, Bob, July 27th. Go back to that time, and the Apollo 13 movie had just come out. Lots of people talking about space, and Jim Lovell was honored for his contributions to space exploration in Washington, D.C. Now, astute listeners will say, wait a minute, Jim was not from Chicago, and that's right. He was from Cleveland, Ohio, born there originally, lived part of his life in Milwaukee, but has since spent much of his adult life here, or all of his adult life here in Chicago, residing on the North Shore, and just a spectacular presence in town because of the way he has given back. He is the astronaut who originally uttered the phrase, "Houston, we've had a problem." That's what they said. Actually, that's what he actually said. I know it's been misquoted to say, "Houston, we have a problem," but that's exactly what he said. We've had a problem. And it's interesting that, just to think about what he's done in our city. If you go to the Adler Planetarium, he's one of the first statues you'll see when you walk in. There's multiple exhibits that reference his work in space. And I pulled a great clip for you, Bob. I think you'll appreciate. This one is Jim Lovell talking with Tom Skilling for a WGN-TV special report a few years ago. And Jim is talking about something from his own childhood that inspired him to give back.
Your interest and your family's interest in Adler Planetarium is so interesting to me. To this day, you believe very seriously in their mission.
Well, when I was in high school in Milwaukee, my interest then was space flight and building rockets and things like this. And so when I came down to visit my aunt in Chicago, the west side of Chicago, I would either take a bus or something like that down downtown Chicago and go visit the Adler Planetarium because I'd heard that it was sort of scientific in nature. And so I went down there and I learned more and more about space flight and things like that before the Adler was really involved in that. I mean, I figured there should be some program, some mission that would be solely interested mainly in space flight, to enhance the population, the advantages of it, and what we're doing.
Correction. This is what Commander Lovell actually said.
Chicago, we got a problem. It's Bob Surratt.
There you go.
Still, I love that.
Still going strong at 97. How about that?
Isn't that great?
And now on to the history of a famous slogan.
Okay, the Morton Salt Company. All right, Bob. So this is interesting. You ever drive by Elston Avenue and you see the big... You know, the big Morton Salt thing with the umbrella, the girl in the umbrella.
Many times.
And over the years. Right. And over the years, you're like, okay, I knew Morton Salt was based there. But fascinating, fascinating history. It started operations 140 years ago. Joy Morton invested in a salt mining company. Salt wasn't mined in Chicago, but almost all of it moved through here through our rail lines. And so he said, I'm going to invest in salt. And when you think of salt, what's the most iconic image that comes to mind? It's the Morton Salt girl, right, with the umbrella. Certainly table salt, right? So she appeared first, the first time she appeared, Bob, 113 years ago. She became the iconic symbol of the brand. And you ask why the umbrella, what's that all about? The image designed to show that Morton salt would pour freely in wet weather, unlike other salts that would get clumpy and stuck if there was any moisture on them and you'd have to throw it away. So the slogan was added, when it rains, it pours. And Morton's would still pour when it got wet. So we pulled a clip of a red shirt TV ad, Morton Salt Girl, local TV, I think from the 1960s, this one, Bob.
It's still there, isn't it, Anna?
Still, I honestly just drove by yesterday. No, was it over the weekend, I think. And, it, you know, there's a, they have that salt shed concert venue over there. So there were like hundreds of people walking over. So it's been repurposed, but she's still there, I can confirm.
This week in Chicago history, continuing with Anna DeVlantis, let's talk about the hot dog stand that was also a sort of a museum of Chicago memorabilia, Chicago the band. Anna?
Yeah, Bob, did you know that connection between the iconic Demon Dogs? Yeah, because if you went in there, the Demon Dogs under the Fullerton L stop, there was sort of a memorabilia area for the band Chicago in there. And, you know, they celebrated the band. And the reason was because the manager of the band was actually the owner of Demon Dogs right there under the Fullerton L stop for 20 years. And, you know, you could grab a hot dog and jump on the L. And it was this very popular late night spot for DePaul students after all the bars poured out in Lincoln Park. Lots of people would head over to Demon Dogs and there'd be a line. But it was built this year, 1983, opened this week. The CTA leased the land to the manager of the band, Chicago, Peter Schiaparelli. He put up the hot dog stand. And interesting, he was a former streets and sand superintendent and also the former head of Snow Command and then turned manager for the band Chicago, but got into the hot dog business while managing the band and then built that memorabilia area all over the walls, you know, just to kind of celebrate this incredible band from here. And interesting, you know this, Bob, Chicago Transit Authority was the original name for Chicago. They shortened it to Chicago. And the history is that in the end, it was the CTA, the Chicago Transit Authority, that shut down Demon Dogs. They operated for 20 years, and then the CTA said, no, we need the land for the Brown Line expansion. So they ended their lease, and bye-bye, Demon Dogs.
Founding members of Chicago were DePaul students. Now on to the history of, this is interesting, because it's hard to recollect the time you'd be folding and unfolding a big road map to get around, right?
I got to ask you about you and Marianne in a second, but okay, so anyone who's ever taken a road trip before the age of GPS, you may remember using the old-fashioned paper road maps because you had to rely on them when you took your trip. You know, you'd get the station wagon loaded up, you'd throw the kids in the back, the dog, all your stuff. But before that, you would sit down and you'd carefully analyze the map, the paper road maps, and we can thank a local company, Rand McNally, for getting us to our destinations for all those years using those paper road maps. They were started out, it's interesting because they started out mapping and documenting the nation's rail lines, and that was their first business. So they even, true story, Charles Lindbergh used Rand McNally maps to navigate his flights over land based on looking at the rail lines and where he would know where he was flying as one of his measurement tools. But the Rand McNally Company started in 1913. Andrew McNally and his wife went on a road trip from Chicago to Milwaukee, where they stopped along the way and they took pictures of every intersection and the roads and major landmarks. And when they got back, they produced the Chicago-Milwaukee Guide, which was the very first road map from their company. And then from there, we went on our road trips, Bob. The problem was, did you remember the pressure of being the navigator? Because you had to look at the map. And if you took a wrong turn or a wrong exit, it was on you.
Yeah,
like, what are you doing? We missed our exit.
Yeah.
Did you and Marianne ever have any arguments surrounding these kinds of things, Bob?
Oh, all the time. And she's got a great sense of direction. I don't know where I am half the time. And by the way, I think Mrs. Lindbergh was in the cockpit back on that flight.
She must have been. You turned the wrong way. We're going north. What are you doing?
That was, 1913. This week in 1913, Rand McNally Maps born. I can't believe that Rainbow Cone is 99 years old. Wow.
Now, okay, it's a Southside institution, Bob. Do you remember getting the Rainbow Cone? Did you ever go over there to Beverly and get the original?
Absolutely.
You did.
Mm-hmm. Okay, yeah, I ventured from the north side to get it.
You did occasionally.
Yeah.
I never made it over there until recently, like I became an adult. But did you like the Rainbow Cone, the signature one with, you know, all the flavors?
I didn't know what to make of it, really. It took a few test runs before I started to like it. It's different.
Me too. Okay, so the five flavors, for those who are uninitiated, it's five flavors: chocolate, strawberry, Palmer House, which is a vanilla cherry mixed with walnuts. And then on top of that, they put pistachio and then orange sherbet, which just sounds terrible if you think about it all together, right? But somehow on a hot day, nothing better than the original Rainbow Cone. So back in 1926, started by Joseph Sapp and his wife, Catherine. I don't know if we have time for the audio here, but his third generation, Lynn Sapp, is now in charge. And she says it's since become the place of first dates, proposals, weddings. It's just become this iconic place, but also a very sentimental place in the neighborhood.
Yeah, here it is. And now they're all over the north side, aren't they?
That's right. They're all over the north side. I just saw one in New Buffalo, Michigan. I was passing through, and they're expanding across the country. Who knows? It might become the next Potbellies or Priscilla's or something, but it's out there. You can go get one.
Yeah, they're on their way to that. Anna, thank you. Talk to you next Wednesday.